This week on Making Contact.
They didn't carry out a coup d'etat to later hand over the power. They did it to stay there, and they were prepared to kill, to repress, to take away the freedom of expression and all the rights of the Honduran people.
Last June, a military coup ousted the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya Rosales. In November, Honduras took global center stage again when conservative businessman Porfirio Lobo Sosa was declared the new president-elect. But that election is mired in controversy, and world reaction remains split. On this edition, we hit the streets of Honduras to look at the roots of a long-standing conflict between a powerful oligarchy and the poor and dispossessed majority who've united to fight back for their rights. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. In June, Honduran President Manuel Zelaya Rosales was forced into exile after trying to hold a popular referendum, an up or down vote on whether to install a fourth ballot in November's general election. This ballot would have called for the formation of a national constitutional assembly for the incoming government that could potentially rewrite constitutional law on the length of presidential terms. Zelaya's critics accused him of trying to pave the way for a possible re-election, a claim Zelaya emphatically denies. Independent producer Chris Thomas has more from Honduras.
Honduras is a small Central American nation of some 7.5 million people. Its history is dominated by interests of transnational corporations and U.S. military involvement, as well as being the base for the School of the Americas-run counterinsurgency campaigns in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. Home to the largest U.S. military base in the region, Palmerola, more than 70% of the Honduran economy is tied directly to the United States, and currently more than 1 million Hondurans reside in the north. And yet Honduras is one of Latin America's poorest countries, with 60% of the population living in extreme poverty, while 10 high-powered families control nearly 90% of the country's resources. Salvador Zúñiga, leader of the Indigenous Peoples Council of Honduras and member of the National Front of Resistance, explains.
Fíjese que hay más de 800,000 niños que terminan el sexto grado y ahí no pueden porque no existe la posibilidad.
In Honduras, there are more than 800,000 children that only finish the sixth grade. That's because in many regions, the schools don't even continue to the seventh grade. Then there are more than 900,000 children who don't have the chance to go to school at all. All of this in a rich country. Honduras is not a poor country. What the people want is a change from this unjust model that permits the oligarchy to continue to get richer, that sucks the blood out of the people. What people want is justice and equality.
El pueblo quiere que haya justicia, que haya equidad.
This thirst for justice exerted tremendous pressure on President Manuel Zelaya, a landowner from the department of Olancho. He was elected in 2006. Thanks in part to the confidence invested in him by Liberal Party members of the country's landed elite. In spite of this, Zelaya's openness to the demands of the Honduran social movement gave way to a series of reforms that increasingly distance him from this ruling class. Berta Cáceres, leader of the Indigenous Peoples Council of Honduras and member of the National Front of Resistance.
Él aumenta el salario mínimo. Eso.
He raised the minimum wage, and that was truly blasphemy in the eyes of the business owners. The very same day that this was made public, President Zelaya had 400 lawsuits filed against him by those very same people. Another thing he did was the proposal to continue a project that would tax the transnational corporations, the fast food restaurants and maquiladoras, because they don't pay any taxes. All they leave in this country is misery and exploitation.
Berta says that such reforms, along with the integration of Honduras into the ALBA, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, and other regional integration projects, contributed to his unprecedented popular support.
In spite of the systematic media attacks, which began the first day he took office, a phenomenon occurred in Honduras. No other president ever had public support in their last year in office. Zero. Yet Zelaya, just one day before the popular referendum that was violated by those dictators, maintained an unheard-of approval rating of nearly 70%.
The initial support Zelaya enjoyed among the nation's elite eroded as they began to feel their interests threatened by these reforms. Adolfo Facuse, member of one of the country's most powerful families and president of the National Industrial Association of Honduras, speaks about his reaction to some of Zelaya's policies.
He opened fire on private business interests, not us. We were defending ourselves from him, and we tried to reason with him, to convince him to change. I spoke with him as a friend, saying, "Don't do that. You're getting yourself into problems. You're going to get all of us into problems." But he didn't change. Private companies shouldn't be subjected to politics. Private companies just want to work and make money. That's our function.
These divisions exploded on June 28th, the day that Zelaya's proposed popular referendum was taking place. This yes or no vote to install a fourth ballot in November's general elections was to pave the way for a national constituent assembly under the following administration. The controversy sparked by this initiative ended in Zelaya's dismissal of School of the Americas graduate General Romeo Vasquez Velasquez for refusing to obey his order to distribute these ballots. Guillermo Amador is a student leader and member of the National Front of Resistance Against the Coup.
Llegamos al 28 con un montón de transformaciones sociales. El presidente estaba consultándole al pueblo.
We came to June 28th with a tremendous amount of social transformations. President Zelaya was consulting with the people to see if they wanted an extra ballot on the general elections so they could decide whether to convene a national constituent assembly. It was only a poll, but the politicians feared the poll would be widely supported, and they realized there was tremendous enthusiasm in the country for this referendum. When they saw that the enthusiasm and participation of the poll far exceeded that of the elections, they realized that people were going to take to the streets after the consult, demand the National Constituent Assembly and Congress, and pressure them to pass legislation placing the fourth ballot on the ticket. With all of this pressure, an insurrection could already be seen.
On June 28th, the armed forces, led by Vasquez Velasquez, broke down the door of the presidential palace, detained the president in his pajamas, and expatriated him to neighboring Costa Rica, the 21st century's first successful military coup in Latin America. Guillermo continues.
So they wanted to avoid the insurrection in favor of the National Constituent Assembly. They thought that by carrying out a coup d'etat, it could be avoided, but they were wrong. They didn't see this coming. Essentially, they believed that since this was in Honduras, a scandal would only last a week or two at the most, and that this would only last 1 or 2 weeks.
Berta Cáceres described the people's reaction to the coup.
Porque el pueblo hondureño explosionó, salió a las calles.
The Honduran people erupted and took to the streets without waiting for orders from anyone. They've now developed a dynamic structure of the resistance front. They organized from their distinct realities and in their own communities. They had their own activities and made their own decisions. At the national level, there's diverse representation. This broad participation is important and is another quality of this resistance.
Otra riqueza de esta resistencia.
Throughout the country, average citizens, from farmers to union members and students to street vendors, are more organized than ever before. The feminist bloc is among these sectors. Adelaide Reyes works at the Center for Women's Rights and is one of the founding members of this coalition.
Pues nosotras surgimos el primer día del golpe de estado.
On the first day of the coup, we awoke to planes in the sky, no electricity, and all of the radio and television stations off the air. We immediately began calling one another to figure out what to do. We needed to discuss what was happening in Honduras. So we gathered spontaneously in front of the presidential palace. We met there for about 3 days talking with one another. Then all of the women's organizations decided to meet right there in front of the palace. There, collectively, we had our first meeting, made our first banners, our first signs, and it was then that we came up with our name, Feminists in Resistance. We are a coalition of women's and feminist organizations from throughout the country who announced very clearly our opposition to the coup.
De mujeres, de organizaciones feministas del país que nos hemos manifestado claramente en contra del golpe de Estado.
Es difícil, la gente.
It was difficult. People didn't realize at first what was happening. It's like when you get punched and you get stunned at first. The shock from this blow lasted about a week. But when people saw us in the streets, the resistance began growing, little by little. The marches were initially around 300 people. But as the days passed, the resistance began to gather more support.
As months passed, the National Front of Resistance Against the Coup gained momentum. They marched every day in Tegucigalpa and throughout the country. They blocked highways and ports, closed borders, held cultural events and concerts, and councils of resistance were born in the most distant corners of the country. Berta explains how a new constitution became the primary demand for a movement that felt its current one is obsolete.
El desarrollo de en estos tres meses del proceso de resistencia ha permitido que se pase de la.
The development of the process of resistance over these months has allowed us to pass from the demand for the restitution of the president to now call for a national democratic constituent assembly for the people. Not any kind of constituent assembly, because the people on the right also have them, the capitalists and the oligarchs, but rather a national constituent assembly that responds to the interests of the Honduran people. In this sense, we are putting forth ideas that will touch the interests of the oligarchy, themes that will change the interests of the transnationals, of the United States, of free trade agreements, privatization, of the systematic sacking of our resources, energy, work, women, children, indigenous and black people's self-determination, sovereignty, independence, water, human rights and sexual diversity, fundamental rights like health and education. And this, for me, is one of the greatest achievements of this resistance movement.
Elementales para la vida, salud, educación. Y esto me parece que es uno de los mayores logros de esta resistencia.
As the resistance continued to grow, so did military and police repression. National curfews were declared. Media outlets sympathetic to the resistance were raided and closed down, and civil liberties were greatly curtailed. August 5th witnessed one of the many attacks of police forces against protesters in the outskirts of Tegucigalpa. Carlos H. Reyes is the president of the Union of Beverage and Related Industry Workers, ex-presidential candidate on the independent ticket, and one of the many victims of this attack, suffering multiple fractures in his hand and forearm.
At the same time that the resistance was organizing itself, as it began to grow, the repression increased along with it, because the people who headed the coup carried it out to stay in power. They didn't carry out a coup d'etat to later hand over the power. They did it to stay there, and they were prepared to kill, to repress, to take away labor rights, the right of association and organization, to take away the freedom of expression and all the rights of the Honduran people. This is what we have seen throughout this entire process.
From the first days of the coup, a brutal repression was unleashed against the resistance on the streets and in their homes. Adela Reyes explains the particular brutality of this repression carried out against the women of the movement.
Pero la represión se ha hecho contra todas las mujeres que han participado en la resistencia.
This repression has been carried out against all of the women who have participated in the resistance. And it is distinct from the repression experienced by men, because it is directed at our bodies as women. The soldiers beat us in the hips, the breasts, and the vagina. And the threat of sexual aggression is always present when there is repression in the streets. Not just threats, in fact, because we have 10 documented cases of rape carried out by police officers since the coup.
Multiple independent human rights organizations have continually denounced flagrant violations in the wake of the coup. More than 4,000 illegal detentions, 28 assassinations, hundreds of illegal search and seizures, torture, and the resurgence of paramilitary death squads have been reported. The de facto government, along with police and military forces, have repeatedly denied these allegations of abuse and even deny that the events of June 28th constitute a coup. Roberto Micheletti served as a congressman for nearly 3 decades and is the current de facto president of Honduras.
Here, the military coups have been just that, military coups, where the military comes into power and stays in power, calling upon some civilians from different political parties to the government to help them run it. But this isn't the case. Those times have passed. There hasn't been a single death confirmed by the police or military in Honduras. But for some reason, this is still being discussed.
In the wake of the November 29th elections, Porfirio Pepe Lobo Sosa was declared president-elect in what coup leaders called the most successful and transparent elections in the history of Honduras. Over the last 5 months, these elections have been repeatedly trumpeted by both political and business leaders as a potential end to the political crisis provoked by the coup. Amilcar Bulnes, the president of the Honduran National Business Council, is one of these voices.
For Hondurans, the best way to end this conflict is with the elections that were planned over a year ago. There is an institution that is above the executive power, and that is the Supreme Electoral Tribunal. It has complete and total autonomy, and in this process, the President of the Republic does not intervene. It is totally autonomous and based in law, and that is the way to solve this conflict.
The elections, however, are mired in controversy. The resistance and the majority of the international community claim that in light of the continuing repression and lack of civil liberties, conditions to carry out transparent elections simply did not exist, adding that fraudulent elections would merely serve to validate the June 28th military coup. Berta speaks on the role of the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, in charge of coordinating the elections.
Another point is that the Supreme Electoral Tribunal are in fact coup participants. They were named just before the coup, illegally, with a coup in mind. They are a crucial piece in these elections, and there are many situations where this can be seen. For example, they are in charge of guaranteeing the transparency of these elections. The coup leaders are calling on private business owners to participate as observers, while these are the same business owners that have been financing the right wing in Honduras to maintain the dictatorship.
In addition to the questionable partiality of the national electoral observers, Laura Carlson, director of the America's Policy Program, tells us about the nature of the international observers brought in to legitimize this electoral process.
Because we have serious concerns about the impartiality of these people and where they are pulling them from. We know for a fact that the National Endowment for Democracy is sending teams from both the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute, both of which are funded by the NED. The other organizations include some of the anti-Castro, very hardline groups from Miami, according to news reports. And then there are reports that there are right-wing groups from throughout the hemisphere that are taking place in this, and we've run into some of those people. So there's also a great concern that the international observers have been pulled from the right wing of the political spectrum.
Prior to the elections, and particularly now in their wake, the resistance, international institutions, and human rights groups have called for the elections not to be recognized because of the conditions in which they were carried out. Luis Guillermo is the Secretary General of the International Human Rights Federation.
Bueno, nosotros estamos llamando a la comunidad internacional a no reconocer el resultado de estas elecciones.
We are calling on the international community to not recognize the results of these elections. We believe that, not for the way they were carried out, but for the context in which they were carried out, they could have a grave impact for the region. It would imply the admission that 3 or 4 powerful families that control the media can carry out a coup with armed forces and expect that there be elections. This This would open the doors to coups throughout Latin America, and we cannot let this go unpunished. In light of this, we continue demanding, from a human rights perspective, that neither the electoral process or its results be recognized internationally.
¿Cuánto le han hecho al señor presidente Manuel Zelaya Rosales?
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Ireland, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org.
Since the day of the coup, there has been widespread speculation as to the extent of U.S. involvement in its execution and its reinforcement in the months following. Laura Carlson explains.
The Obama administration came out strong with the rest of the continent to condemn the coup from the very beginning when it happened and signed on to the UN and the Organization of American States resolutions. However, they then began to take a less firm stance in many statements. Instead of calling for the restitution of the president, they would refer very vaguely to restoring democratic order. But the real betrayal of their original position occurred when the October 29th agreement of Tegucigalpa was signed. And the history of that is that on October 20th, over a week before this agreement was negotiated and signed, Subsecretary Tom Shannon went to Republican Senator Jim DeMint, who had opposed both the Obama policy in Honduras and Tom Shannon's own confirmation as ambassador to Brazil, as well as the confirmation of Arturo Valenzuela as Subsecretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs. They apparently agreed that they would negotiate to have the coup remain in power and to carry out the elections in Honduras in return for these confirmations. That, as we later saw, was exactly what happened, despite the fact that many people agreed or believed that the October 29th agreement would lead to the restoration of democracy in Honduras. Instead, they completely skipped this step, went straight to elections carried out by a coup regime, and the United States, by all appearances, will be recognizing those elections and calling on many of its allies in the hemisphere to recognize them as well. This is a huge disappointment because it's a clear reflection and continuation of the Bush policy of dividing the Latin America between the countries that are led by center-left progressive governments like Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, and Ecuador, and the countries that have right-wing governments and free trade agreements with the United States. This division is purposeful, and it's designed to tighten up the dependency of the governments that are more closely allied with the United States, while at the same time digging into the efforts of regional unity that the progressive governments have been trying to establish.
Berta explains the importance of such policies in order to maintain U.S. military domination in the region.
The United States knows that whenever they want, they will use the armed forces in whichever way they desire in certain circumstances, and they can always change the roles of these armed forces according to their interests. So I don't see that there have been any changes in the armed forces or that the gringos have made any changes in the armed forces in Honduras, because they themselves trained and financed them. Romeo is a graduate of the School of the Americas, as are the other coup generals. They know that they are a necessary piece for the U.S. interests in the region. This isn't coincidence. Along with the Panamanian and Colombian armies, we already know that we're in the middle of a regional military project, a project of hemispheric domination, led by the gringos, carried out through the reactivation of the Fourth Fleet, Plan Colombia, and Plan Merida.
Carlos H. Reyes agrees.
Porque lo que se nos viene de ahora en adelante no es nada fácil.
What comes next is not at all easy for the countries of Latin America. We have to be very clear on this. The United States already has Honduras in its plans as a police force for Central America. From here, they go against El Salvador and Nicaragua, and the same goes for Colombia, against the countries of South America. These people are ready to put an end to all of the integrationist processes that we have been developing across the continent.
Adolfo Facuse has been signaled as one of the primary intellectual and financial authors of the June 28th coup and the expatriation of Zelaya from Honduras. He and other coup planners are well aware of the regional implications.
Right now, what is happening? Some governments are afraid. In Ecuador, Correa is terrified that what happened in Honduras will happen to him. In Nicaragua, they're all saying that we have them in our sights, and we are prepared to send off in their pajamas whichever president we see fit.
The day after the elections, amidst continued repression, detentions, and raids, the resistance drove through the streets, displaying their clean fingers to demonstrate that nobody had gone to vote. Hundreds greeted the caravan as it passed through the more marginalized neighborhoods of the capital, Tegucigalpa, cheering them on and chanting. The caravan ended outside the Brazilian embassy, where President Manuel Zelaya has taken refuge since his discreet return to the country on September 21st, and where he remains today at the time of this report. The future is still unclear, but one thing remains certain: the resistance will continue. The coming months will be decisive for the movement, which faces an increased atmosphere of repression, torture, and assassinations, but still remains firm in their struggle for a new constitution and a new nation. Adelaide Reyes with the Center for Women's Rights.
So we know that the elections are not going to calm down anything. Maybe they will give us the sensation that this period has ended, that the process has stopped, but that's not how it is. If we continue with our proposal, then we know what we are going to face. But it's not worth it to live in a world without freedom. It's not worth it to step out of your house and see that the military is the owner of your country. No. That's why we have to continue.
Sí, entonces hay que seguir, pues.
Lo que sí nosotros también sostenemos es...
We maintain that the Honduran people in all of this process have given birth to something important, and that is the resistance. The leaders of the coup were the midwives of the resistance, and this resistance is going to be the coup leader's gravedigger. It is going to bury the Constitution of 1982, and it is going to bury the old Honduras and give birth to a new Honduras.
For Making Contact, I'm Chris Thomas, Tegucigalpa, Honduras.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. To listen to an interview with Lisa Sullivan from SOA Watch, log on to our website at radioproject.org. Special thanks to Chris Thomas and Tim Russo for this report. Making Contact is supported by listeners like you. You allow us to continue to offer our programming for free to radio stations across the U.S. and in Canada, Ireland, and South Africa. Thank you. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Pauline Bartoloni, producer and online editor, Andrew Stelzer, producer, Con Pham, associate director, Megan Martini, our media consortium intern, and Rita Daniels and Lakeisha Thomas, interns. And I'm Tina Rubio, and from all of us at Making Contact, happy holidays.